Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Okay, and that, of course, was our original guy who started this Brown Briefly. That's Brian Brown, and we certainly do appreciate his starting this and appreciate the folks who are continuing on with the Brown Briefly. We're trying something a little different today. This is your host, Truman O'Brien, for the moment. Brian used to refer to me as the sound engineer and mood modulator. So today I'm going to also be the moderator because we have something we're trying a little different. Instead of everyone coming into the studio today, we are all now connected by Zoom. And I have everyone on the board right now. Everyone's at home on their laptops. And we have today with us Kevin Jones, of course, with Indivisible Vachon, and a noted sailor, I believe. And Kevin, are you there?
I'm here, True. We're coming to you from formerly sunny Squim, but we still have a wonderful view across the straits to Canada, where we currently cannot go, but we're admiring it nonetheless.
All right, from a distance. That's great. Next up is Lynn Kerrigan, a social worker, poet, singer, and a very, very smart person.
Coming to you from lockdown in Ellisport.
All right. And actually, I have to make one caveat here. In the studio with me this morning, clear across the room with her back to me is Susan McCabe, writer, actor, talk show host. In fact, she's going to be hosting Real Talk right after this show. Who do you have on today, Susan?
Today, we're going to be talking about media literacy with Dr. Marilyn Cohen, who is an expert on that topic at the University of Washington. And boy, isn't it a hot topic right now. It's basically, what is media literacy and how can we save ourselves when we understand it?
Boy, isn't that the truth. Oh, my gosh. And last but not least, of course, who's actually going to be the host today is Bruce Holman, college professor, island historian, and Brian used to refer to him the guardian of the galaxy. And boy, we certainly believe that. And he's recently back from Australia, New Zealand. Welcome home, Bruce.
It's good to be here, Truman. Very good to be here. So, I just got back a week ago from New Zealand. And I was very impressed with how the New Zealand government, the Prime Minister, Jacinda Ardern, has handled this COVID-19 crisis compared to what's happened here in the United States. And I asked Truman to find a clip. She did an address to the nation about 4 or 5 days ago. And then recently, just yesterday, had another press conference in which she announced a stage 4 sort of lockdown of New Zealand. Everybody except essential workers need to stay home and shelter in place. And so New Zealand has taken a very different approach to this crisis than the United States has. And Truman, if you can play that clip of her speech.
I can. So let's give it a try. Here we go.
I understand that all of this rapid change creates anxiety and uncertainty, especially when it means changing how we live. That's why today I'm going to set out for you as clearly as possible what you can expect as we continue to fight the virus together.
Okay, so I got to most of that. Is that the most part that you wanted there, Bruce?
We couldn't hear it, so
couldn't
I don't
hear
know.
It.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, the folks
at difficulties here.
Yeah, the folks at home could. I ran from the. She basically just was telling folks she's going to lay out for them exactly what's expected of them in their stay-at-home mode.
So exactly.
Yeah. All right. Sorry. Now let me see if I can find the other one here for you, but continue on.
Well, I think what's impressive about what Prime Minister Ardern did was she was very forthright and very open with the public, very transparent, saying, hey, we've got this crisis coming. I'm going to tell you exactly what we're doing. And she's going to do it in a very sort of organized way. And then her speech goes on for another 6 or 7 minutes in which she just laid out essentially the kinds of things that the New Zealand government was doing. They locked down the borders. They've set up isolation and camps where needed. They've mobilized resources for hospitals. They've now instituted a stage 4 lockdown, which means nobody's out except essential workers, health workers, and essential workers. So it's been a very interesting sort of response. When I left a little over a week ago, there were 5 cases in New Zealand. Yesterday, there were just over 102 cases. No deaths so far. Now, New Zealand's a very small country, 5 million people. It's isolated from the rest of the world. So in many ways, relatively easy to institute these things. But it's been done in a very open, very sort of way that the public knows what's going on. And I think that's in contrast to what we see happening here. And I asked Truman to find a clip from one of President Trump's press conferences. So Truman, if you can play that.
Yeah, I can. Hang on 1 second, and let's see how this one goes.
Yeah, we can hear that.
Okay, hang on. Here we go.
I'd say the Americans were scared, though. I guess nearly 200 dead, 14,000 who were sick, millions, as you witnessed, who are scared right now. What do you say to Americans who are watching you right now who are scared?
I say that you're a terrible reporter. That's what I say.
I think it's a very nasty question, and I think it's a very bad signal that you're putting out to the American people.
The American people are looking for answers, and they're looking for hope. And you're doing sensationalism, and the same with NBC and Comcast. I call it Comcast. Let me just ask for whom you work. Let me just tell you something. That's really bad reporting. And you ought to get back to reporting instead of sensationalism. Let's see if it works.
Okay, I know that you folks, the people at home could hear that, but I know that the people on the panel here could not hear that. But in essence, for you guys who are on the panel, that was Donald Trump trashing the reporter who just threw him a nice softball that would allow him to look very presidential in comforting folks who are frightened, and instead he attacked the reporter. I'm sure that's what you were talking about.
Is this where Peter Alexander asked him, what do you say to Americans who are scared? And he basically responded with, you're a bad reporter.
That's the one. Right. Yep.
The one. Yep. Yep.
So, all right. So we see one little glitch in our plan here, folks. So you guys can't hear those things. We'll figure that out. I think I have a way to do that next week. So
yeah, Kevin.
All right. Hey, it's really intriguing, this comparison that we obviously set up for our listener to understand the differences in leadership. But I was on a teleconference with a group of folks from the Washington Indivisible Network the other day, and a woman who's probably in her mid-30s, I'm guessing, who's been quite instrumental in engaging on the political front here in Washington, helped us substantially in the 8th Congressional District, to now have a Democrat, Dr. Kim Schreier, in that seat. She said, I've grown up here in Western Washington my entire life. I'm a U.S. born and raised person. And this notion of American exceptionalism has really been drilled into my psyche. She herself works at Microsoft. She's working on secure cloud-based computing for various institutions, very challenging technical arena. And what she's seeing in front of her is this example of American exceptionalism that is really suffering today. And I said, of course, there's a few myths about American exceptionalism, but unfortunately, we have the benefit of seeing some of these play out in front of us every day now.
I heard on NPR this morning that the United States is becoming the epicenter of the COVID-19 virus, in large part because we were unprepared. It's I'm causing echo.
Feedback,
right. Anyway, the virus is spreading exponentially because we're unprepared. We can't test it. So we don't know how many people have it and who's supposed to stay away from whom.
You know, there were two things that I saw. Oh, I'm sorry, Lynn, go ahead.
It's all right. I was just going to mention that I saw the NPR or listened to the NPR program this morning, too, about not only, you know, these sort of differences in leadership styles between the public health factual information that we're getting and Trump's desire to get the economy rolling. And that was the thing that kind of surprised me about the way his conversations have been going with the people. You know, I think he's so worried that he's going to lose the election if the economy tanks that he can't quite wrap his head around how to manage the public health crisis first. And, you know, for me, it's just kind of shameful for him to say he's going to speak out to get people back to work next week after his 2-week lockdown order, you know, is over. So I just think we have to listen to the public health people.
You know, I was thinking there, Lynn, he should just get over it and realize he's not going to win the election and he should just get on with running the country in a responsible way.
I agree.
You know, I think it's, to me, it's fascinating to sort of look back at American history and look at that sort of tension that's always and built into the very structure of our country and our political system is the tension between federal power and state power. And essentially, federal power, as a result of the Civil War, trumps, in a word, you know, state power. But in reality, what we're seeing right now is the states are providing the leadership, not the federal government. And the federal government people who are providing leadership, like Tony Fauci, are being shunted aside. It's very, very unfortunate. And so we're lucky to have governors like Newsom in California, you know, our own Inslee, Cuomo in New York, who are stepping up and taking leadership positions on a national level when they're really state leaders.
Yeah, you know, I was going to comment on that, Bruce. My wife recently said, boy, this for the states' rights folks, this is really significant about what's happening. The states are really taking the lead on this. And I think doing a heck of a job of getting their states in order. Now, if we could just get
that
the
phrase
rest of
should
the country.
Be banned. You remember, you're doing a heck of a job, Brownie, which Bush said to his New Orleans counterpart.
All right.
His FEMA counterpart after New Orleans floods.
Right. Hmm. Susan,
I am hearing about New York and Washington State. I haven't heard much about the states in the middle of the country. Has anybody had any information about how they're handling this?
I did hear an interview with, I think it was from Michigan, the governor of Michigan. In fact, who sent the tweet to Trump that said, "Quit tweeting and do your job"? One of the governors really nailed him.
I think it was Ohio.
Oh, is it Ohio?
But Louisiana, the governor of Louisiana. Right now, Louisiana has the fastest growing rate of COVID-19 of any place in the world. And Louisiana's not ready for it. And the governor is very forthright about the problems that he's having and the response that he's getting from the federal government. I don't know if you saw Cuomo's press conference this morning. He requested, $300,000 or 400,000 respirators. Federal government responded, they're sending him 3,000 or 30,000. I can't remember the number, but it's insignificant right now. Kevin?
Yeah, and you know, they talk about the number, I've heard different numbers on how many respirators might be needed. And so I think that still trying to really catalog and inventory, you know, how much resource we really have. Somebody asked a question about the states in the middle of the country and what they're doing. I think I saw last night that there's some now 20 some states that have instituted some type of a stay-at-home order or have shut down things like restaurants and bars. And I don't remember all of them, but I, with 20 states, there's definitely some in the middle of the country that are starting to react now.
Right.
And I think what's going to be fascinating as we watch this is that this is hitting rural areas in a much slower pace right now than it is hitting urban areas. But when you look at all the charts from every place that COVID-19 has hit, is the growth rate tends to be similar. I mean, the expansion of the infection rate tends to be similar. And so what you're going to see in rural areas that are not set up as well as urban areas are for these kinds of emergencies, it's going to be a disaster. Susan?
I had heard, and I don't know if this is true, I think it's something Luke saw on Facebook, that the Texas governor was saying that people over 70 should be willing to sacrifice their lives so that the retail economy can get back on its regular footing.
Yeah, and of course, Donald Trump is 73.
I'm glad I don't live in Texas.
Did anybody point that out to him?
Did he move to Texas?
Yeah. Can move we get to Trump Texas. To move to Texas?
Oh, right.
Okay.
Yeah.
One thing I have been keeping track of is the number of King County cases. And it's kind of, you see these plots, right? If you watch some of the reporting, and here's what's going on in China and South Korea and Italy and so on. In King County, we are still on a rapid increase. And, it's hard to know how much of that is new cases versus how much of that is actually increased, testing. But if I take a look at the data, it's intriguing to me that just over the last, say, 4 days, over the last 5 days, we've had over 100 new cases per day. But it's kind of interesting. It jumped up to like 130 and then 100, 140, 100, 130. So it might actually be kind of on a steady ramp instead of an exponentially increasing ramp. The number of deaths is still increasing. We had a number 12 people died in King County yesterday after only one person on the 22nd. So we'll see what happens locally in our own King County and see when that curve starts to bend over. But so far, it's not flattening yet.
So I want to point out something positive. I think we need to, I mean, this is all well and good. The numbers are important and the effort by the states is important. But I think locally, I'm pretty proud of what Vashon has been doing. I think if you look at the grocery stores, the way they're setting things up, even the hardware store, they've got spacing set up so that you can't come up close to the clerks. I think it's wonderful. And I don't see much traffic at all. The downtown looks like a ghost town. So anyway, I think we should all pat ourselves on the back a little bit for that.
I saw that, IGA has a senior only shopping time from 7 to 8 in the morning, and both stores with their curbside delivery, and careful sanitation of their carts and everything. I think that's really wonderful. And I'm hopeful that since we're less densely populated than an urban area, that if we can all really keep our social distance and use those sanitary precautions, we'll keep our rate lower. I want to believe that.
Kevin.
Yeah, and I think it's really the community standing up and doing those things is really awesome. In my mind, it goes, there's a couple of plot lines that I think are really important, is what are we doing that's on the good side, and realizing when those actions have an effect in the broader community in which we're likely to interact and move around. And I fear that the rhetoric coming from the White House, let's open up the country again, get the economy back going, is giving people the impression that a couple weeks and we're good. In the meantime, I think the reality is that anytime that this virus still has a foothold, it can very easily expand again across the entire globe because of the fact of its contagious nature. So I think we have to recognize this reality we're in and maintain our caution so that we can get those numbers looking good. But absolutely, I think it's fantastic what's happening locally on Vashon.
Well, the one thing that I just read this morning, in fact, from one of our fellow producers, said that he recently read that this virus can live for up to like 3 weeks on a surface. So, you know, think about that. We're talking about setting back for 2 weeks. Whoever's doing that, stop. Lynn, I think that you... All right, sorry. We got a lot of noise from somebody. But anyway, if that can live on surfaces for 3 weeks and we're only going to quarantine for 2 weeks, you know, that's what you're talking about, Kevin. We're still liable to have that to come back.
Well, the modeling that I've seen... And I'm sure everybody has seen this, is that, you know, those peaks and troughs that we can expect last 3 months from what I've seen, and that the public health people I've seen on the news have said we will easily be going into the summer with, you know, having to be extremely careful, that we should not underestimate how long it will take to ride that wave and keep that wave blunted so it doesn't overwhelm our hospital system and kind of, you know, have such a terrible sudden peak of deaths. So I think we're in it for the long haul for a while. I don't know how long, but public health will tell us.
Susan?
When we talk about the actions of the state, Governor Inslee, I believe it was yesterday, made a statewide lockdown announcement. And I don't know how it's different from what we were doing before. In other words, he said, stay at home, use social distance, you can walk the trails, playgrounds are closed, non-essential businesses are closed, restaurants can do carry out. How is that different from what we're doing until now? Kevin?
Yeah, my understanding, Susan, is that all of those other provisions of, you know, restaurants, bars being closed, I think now is just one additional layer that says also must stay at home unless you have a specific reason to be out. And some of the issues were, you know, people were going, I heard about the Mount Si Trail, which on a sunny day in the summertime can have probably like literally 500 people on that trail. And people were going out to those trails because kids are out of school, they're looking for something to do, right? People are not going to work. And I think those are the kind of examples where Inslee was seeing the social distancing wasn't being really taken seriously in some of those settings. And so is now taking the additional step of saying, now you must stay at home unless you have some specific reason to be outside the house.
It's a little vague now. Hiking.
Yeah, it's a little vague now because he still says you can go exercise if you stay, if you practice social distancing.
Right.
So I think it's just one more notch in the ladder, I guess, is my understanding of what he's trying to do.
And what I heard about Jay's order to make it a formal lockdown meant that law enforcement could go to those beaches and actually break people up. And it's actually a misdemeanor to violate that gathering, you know, in groups of more than four people. So I think they're really trying to get serious and, you know, have us take it seriously.
Sorry, I got to get my buttons pushed here. I just got a note from my daughter who said that what she's read is that if you make it illegal, you make it a legal order for you to stay home and non-essential businesses to close, like her, that you can legally get unemployment. That's the one of the benefits of him calling for these businesses to close, that it makes you eligible for unemployment. Is that
one? Yeah, I think that's consistent with what I've heard. So just one other data point on the spread of this. Last night I was hearing that there's some possibly positive indicators from Italy, which up until Louisiana was, I think, you know, the one area that was growing fastest in the number of cases, where now they've been national lockdown for 2 weeks. And apparently they're just now starting to see early indicators that the number of cases is starting to slow in Italy. I think, Lynn, you'll know very well, right? We need to let some time and see if that's truly a trend. But the thing that's of interest to me is that in that this country, we do not have that level of shutdown now, right? So the notion that we can control this with piecemeal orders from governors, it's good that they're doing that, but we have to see in whether it's really going to be enough.
Well, you know, what I like about it is that Washington is kind of taking a lead in the U.S. about figuring out what maybe we need to do. And that will spread, I hope, across the country so that others can follow leads that are successful. We'll see if it drops our rates. I hope it does.
And by the way, I made an error, folks. I have to clarify. I said that the virus would last 3 weeks. No, 3 days. Sorry.
Yeah.
Hey, you know, weekday. Sorry about that. But hey, even 3 days is a big deal, you know, if you think about it. So
still lurking out there.
There you go.
Kevin?
Yeah, and the other thing that I saw, maybe true, we were reading the same article, but I saw the 3 days on metal and plastic.
Right.
1 day on cardboard. And the other surprising thing out of the study was that it can stay airborne longer than they expected.
That was what I wanted to know. What did they say?
Yeah, well, they initially thought, you know, 6 foot distance on the virus doesn't really travel from person to person via the air. And they're saying now that they are rethinking that. Apparently they have evidence that indeed it does. But the one thing that they go on to say is the most impacted is going to be people who work in the healthcare profession around a number of people who are, contagious, who do have the virus, because their atmosphere will be a higher density of droplets and other things that are spread that way. I suspect that it's still, I wouldn't bet my health on the findings so far. It's not clear. They did say, however, they really do expect that the virus in those droplets can stay airborne longer than they expected, and that actually a low humidity environment, I was thinking like in the Arizona desert, maybe they dry up really fast. They say they can actually persist longer when it's low humidity or high humidity. So I think the jury's still out on some of this.
I don't understand that at all, because the one thing I heard was it does have to have moisture. I mean, a droplet, you know, it can be pretty darn small, that liquid, but I don't get the incredibly dry climate. That doesn't make sense to me. But
well, I'm glad they're checking it out. I mean, we have to remember this is a new virus. We know nothing about it. We know nothing about its transmissions, and basically, we should be examining every possible avenue that is doing this community spread, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. And I just heard that you probably did too, that they identified two new symptoms that are early, and that is loss of smell and loss of taste.
Yeah. Yes.
It appear to be one of the early onset indicators of having COVID, but there's other stuff that we still don't know. We don't know if once you have it, you are immune. I believe some people have gotten it a second time, though I wouldn't swear to that. And we also have no idea then how long it's going to take to run its course through the human population. In other words, if we isolate for 2 weeks, 2 months, is it done? Do we have herd immunity by that time? We don't know.
You know, another thing that I recently heard I think it was on MSN, where they were talking about the company that makes a thermometer that communicates with your iPhone or your smart device. Have you heard about this?
Yeah.
This is absolutely fascinating. What they found, they've been selling these things for a while, so there's like a million of them out there. And what happens is that when you take your temperature, that's sent to the company. I think it's Kinsa, maybe it's the company, but anyway, that information is sent to the company, and they've been able to track flu epidemics in populations by reading these temperatures. I mean, it's depersonalized, so it's not, you know, you you individually, but they can look at populations and see where there are rises in temperature or fever in people. And now they're finding that's one of the best places to get data on this new virus is from these thermometers. I thought, gosh, what a wonderful thing. So maybe we all ought to go out and buy
one. Does anybody know that brand?
I'm sorry. I'll see if I can find that while we're on the air.
I saw the clip, and I know that they were sort of royal blue with the round
blue head.
And the digital, you know, read was in the little round blue head. But right. It's some sort of smart thermometer that does track your temperature and send it back to the company, and they can tell by spiked fevers who might be getting it quickly.
Exactly.
And it goes along with your social security number and your bank account.
Yeah, and your bank account. No, I don't think so, really.
You know, I get the impression they may have developed that for the flu tracking, as one of the reports sort of referenced that. And another related comment along those lines is the healthcare professionals in the healthcare center in Kirkland were talking about how difficult it was that the coronavirus arrived here during flu season and right. has such similar characteristics. And at that point of our lack of knowledge, we really couldn't tell, you know, whether it was just another flu or something different. And of course, regrettably, it's something very different.
And by the way, it is KINSA. Kinsa is the brand of that particular thermometer.
Yeah, I think, Kevin, your point about the similarity of symptoms, I think that's just what I read briefly in the report about the what happened in the Life Care Center in Kirkland, is that early on, they just thought it was a regular flu bug. And so what they did is they responded to it as regular flu, and that allowed it to sort of spread through that nursing home population. As quickly as it did, because they didn't recognize it was a new virus. And so there's some catch-up going on, I think, on all these levels right now.
Yeah, I understand it was quite an extensive report. I know Susie said that she'd read something that was quite in-depth about what had happened there. And hopefully then the lessons learned, right, that can go out to others.
Well, and also back to your point about healthcare workers, the people working in hospitals, first responders, and the intensity of the amount of particulates in the air. That's what they're seeing in Italy with the high incident of infection among medical workers, among doctors, among first responders. And that's helping to spike, the incidences in Italy is because those folks are working frontline and they're working in environments where it's much more dense sort of infection rates and it's impacting the medical community. And also what we're seeing here and what we're going to be confronting relatively soon is what Italy confronted is that, you know, the hospital facilities are going to be overwhelmed. The number of intensive care beds available are relatively small in the United States. There's what, I can't remember the number, but 30 or 40,000, no, that's not right. It's got to be 300, 400,000 in the United States, intensive care unit beds, whereas the needs could be in the millions. And so that sort of decision process, that triage process of who lives and who dies, who gets in intensive care and who doesn't, that's going to be very, very impactful, isn't it? Kevin?
So Bruce, as our historian, are we going to be setting new historical records for pandemic here? Or does history tell us that we've seen all this before and we just have to bear our way through it?
Well, we saw it with the 1918 Spanish flu epidemic. And it was there's some parallels. I mean, it's, history never repeats itself. As Kit Burns says, history rhymes. You have these sort of recurring patterns. It's like poetry. It's not exactly a repeat, but it's echoes of the past. And in the Spanish flu epidemic, what was fascinating about that is apparently it began in Missouri and was taken to Europe by American troops into the trenches of World War I, where it spread very, very quickly. But because it was a warfare situation, trench warfare, it infected both sides, but neither side let anybody know, because it was military secret that our troops were infected with this new kind of disease. And so it spread very rapidly. It's only when it spread into Spain that it became publicly acknowledged. And that's why we call it the Spanish flu of 1918. In reality, it was American flu that got into the trenches and was suppressed. Information and communications about it was suppressed because of the war efforts by both sides. And so you see some parallels. I mean, the Chinese initially suppressing sort of reports about what was happening in Wuhan. And then when it gets out, it begins to spread very, very rapidly. Well, in 1918, the Spanish flu spread clear around the world, into the South Pacific Islands, into Africa, into South America, every place. And I think that's what we're seeing with this. And in that epidemic, I mean, millions died. Worldwide deaths were up, what, in the 200,000-300,000 right now? I can't remember the actual numbers of deaths.
So Bruce, the mortality percentage that we're looking at now, I think they're talking about 2-3%, something like that. Do you know what what that rate was for the Spanish flu? Have any
idea? Because they didn't keep records in the same way we do.
Right.
Generally, it's viewed as 4-5%, but most medical experts think it was probably close to 10%.
Wow.
And Kevin, do you know the number of deaths in the world right now?
Not off the top of my head, Bruce.
I've seen that number, and I can't remember what it is, but it's spiking rapidly. And what's happening, as you said, and what happened with the Spanish epidemic in 1918, is it started in the spring of 1918. It spread very rapidly. It declined during the summer, and then it came back in the fall of 1918, in September, October, November, and was even more deadly the second time than it was the first time. Because viruses change, viruses mutate. And so what happened in the fall of 1918, it was the highest death rate took place in that second wave. And I think that's what most medical experts are concerned about right now with this COVID-19 epidemic, is that we're only seeing the first wave. The second wave that could come back in the fall could be much, much worse.
The number that I'm seeing right now worldwide is 16,365 deaths.
Right.
I know I took off of, can I say, I know I wrote some figures down from the TV news last night. I think it was Channel 5. That was talking about here, there were 2,000 cases. Does that sound right? And 110 deaths.
Correct.
And that 7% of the tests they have done were positive.
Right. And I looked at what's interesting is if I'm looking at a graph of this is confirmed death graph. And if you look at March 1st, worldwide, there was like 22,900 folks. That's compared to now only, 23 days later, it has spiked up to 16,000 plus. So that is a very rapid rise.
Is that total cases or deaths?
Deaths. And that's worldwide.
Wow.
Wow. And going back to the notion of leadership and how important leadership is, I don't know who saw the footage of from Iran regarding their leadership talking about this as a hoax created by the U.S. and that there were literally faithful who were on video licking the gates of their places of worship to clean the coronavirus off the gates so that people would come out, it would be safe to return to practice the religious activities. The epiphany at that point was that any pocket of this super contagious, if not managed, will basically break out again. but just the ocean leadership responsibility that we talked about at the beginning of the show is really disturbing about how big an effect it has.
Can I make a switch of gears for a minute? Because in our last few minutes, I want to ask, how are people doing with this? Because I find the oddest reactions I'm having are cravings for food from my childhood. Well, I want things that my mother ate.
Well,
she
I hate
to
tell
like
you.
Cottage cheese yeah. and canned peaches. I want it.
Yeah, ice cream.
I want Cracker Jacks.
Ice cream invaded my house yesterday.
Yes, me too.
I want comfort food. I think we're looking for comfort.
There you go.
Definitely.
Or just plain eating. I find that I'm an emotional eater, so I'm eating a whole lot more than I should.
Well, I saw one meme recently that I thought was quite humorous. It was two photographs. It was of a young woman in a kind of a skimpy outfit, but she's reaching into the refrigerator, and it says before COVID-19 and then after COVID-19 and before this slender young woman. And then the second one, she's gained about 60 pounds. Yeah. It's pretty impressive. I think it may be appropriate, however.
Yeah, well, there's different stress reactions. That certainly is one of them.
Right.
Well, I want to say that the Vashon Be Prepared is now working on getting mental health resource list up on their website for people who may be not only needing more information about the virus itself, but needing to touch base about how they're doing and make sure everybody, you know, that you have some support networks set up and that you're able to find ways to stay connected, even if we can't be together.
I figure the fact that I haven't lost my appetite means I don't have COVID-19.
Exactly.
Well, and time for a real pitch here for Voice of Vashon, Vashon Be Prepared, the Medical Emergency Corps, and all the things that are happening right now on Vashon to get us ready for an impact that potentially is coming. And I think if you aren't, a blatant sort of pitch for Voice of Vashon, if you're not on their email list and if you don't get the sort of emergency announcements that come out virtually every day right now, you should. It's very important.
Very helpful.
Staying on top of what's happening here on the island. The Medical Reserve Corps right now is working to set up testing stations here on the island. I mean, so there's a lot going on. And I think neighborhood Neros have joined together. And I think, if you do need help, you know, if you do have questions, contact Vashon Be Prepared, contact Voice of Vashon, contact the fire district. I mean, there are all those emergency response things are getting in place to help us sort of deal with this crisis, because it's not going to go away in the near future. We're going to see this for the next 2, 3, 4 months, maybe even longer.
And I
understand there's a group of mask makers on the island that people are starting to make on the island, surgical masks look, you know, surgical mask designs made out of cloth.
Right.
And there's a Facebook group I know that is doing that. And who knows what those mask will be good for our own anxiety and not sneezing on people, I suppose. But maybe the company that helped Providence, I saw on the news this morning, is working to make surgical grade mask with face shields available now. So hopefully we're going to start getting better protected as well as better prepared.
Let me throw out two more plugs for Voice of Vashon. One, we would really, really like for you to write to info@voiceofvashon.org and let us know how this program came across today. We're trying an experiment using Zoom, where everyone is staying at home, and we're trying to do this as safely as we possibly can. So please, info@voiceofvashon.org and let us know how you like this. And also, we'd like to, folks, if you'd like to sign up to be a sustaining partner with the Voice of Vashon, go to voiceofvashon.org and look at the donate now. So we'll see you all next week.